Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to start by looking at a University of Chicago and China Medical University from Taiwan, a study published in the American Journal of Chinese Medicine that says that Chinese medicine has all of the good science behind it to show that it should be used more in the West. After all, it's over 5,000 years old, and they have a lot of research labs, far more than what we have. They have state-of-the-art science, and so they're using Dong Quai and Fo Tai and ginseng, Gotu Kola, ginkgo biloba, all these herbs, thousands of herbs, in good studies showing that what they had observed clinically between the doctor and the patient works. So we'll talk about that, and we've got a lot more on health and healing, always some peer-reviewed literature. Then I'm going to be sharing some insights on microchips, nanotechnology, and implants. 100 years from now? No. Today. Absolutely right within the next 24 hours. It's here. Remember I said that transhumanism is working with artificial intelligence? To be able to read your thoughts, to be able to have implants in your brain. Did not Elon Musk this week have an interview worldwide where he talked about the brain implant that he's invented? Remember, they only tell you what they want you to know about what it will do, and they always gift wrap it very nicely. Oh, it'll help diagnose earlier on or help with the symptoms of X, Y, and Z disease. What else does it do? Well, they don't tell you. We will, because we know that Profusa, P-R-O-F-U-S-A, has a contract for biointegrated sensors with U.S. Department of Defense and the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency, DARPA. That's really bad. And what the FDA will do about approving this, which it will. Wait till you hear what they're going to do to you. Yeah. All of you, and depending upon where you live, unless we create a resistance. So a lot of the programs I'm going to be doing over the next month will be based upon what I know is coming. A lot of people don't care. That's fine. But for those of you who do care and believe you should have sovereignty over your freedom of choice, of what happens to your mind and body and your freedom, pay attention. Also, they're trying to get the flu vaccine now mandated in New York State and other places for all children. That's a very good idea. Oh, wait. No, it's a terrible idea. Because we have the Corbett report that's done an in-depth original investigative report, as only James Corbett could do, showing you what a disaster that would be for children. Of course, and seniors as well. So we're going to talk about debt today. I'm going to give you a primer of showing you what one of the biggest issues in our entire life is, and we're not facing it. We should. In fact, I just finished dictating, because I have someone who can type faster than what I can talk. And so I dictate a lot of my articles, and it'll be ready on Monday or Tuesday. The 10 most important issues in our lives that we're not facing a single one. Not one. Then what's taking up all of our attention and time, and how relevant is it? Well, it's not relevant, but it's a distraction, and it's an intentional distraction. That article is coming on Monday, but one part of those 10 today. So what we have going on, I'm going to share with you. I'm going to go right through a lot of things today. I do agree with Peter Koenig in Global Research. Peter's a brilliant human being, and he writes, quote, the vaccine should be tested on politicians first. If they survive, the vaccine is safe. If they don't, the country is safe. Well said, Peter. I couldn't agree more. So we're going to deal with a lot of issues in quick succession today. And also Jonathan Haidt. We're going to share his insights on safe spaces and the stifling of vigorous intellectual debate, which we need. He did an interview We'll take a small part of that interview for today. And also, do you remember the media? We predicted it. We said they'll tell you that there was only 3,000 or 3,500 people meeting him in Berlin. These were all neo-fascists, Nazis, right-wingers, alt-right, Trump supporters. And that's exactly what they reported. So we wanted to get the footage, the actual aerial footage, the counts. They were not off by much. They said 3,500. We counted nearly a million. But then again, that's the mainstream media. It's never honest. And no, these were not principally fascists, neo-Nazis. These were citizens from around the world, almost all the countries in the world. And they were there to learn about freedom of choice and health. They were there to learn about the dangers of 5G and electromagnetic frequencies, which we'll talk about today, and their danger. And also the digital currency, which we don't want. Trust me, everyone, you do not, under any conditions, want a digital currency. You want to be able to keep your gold and silver and dollars, because if they control the currency, they control every single aspect of your life. If they put you on one of their lists, like China does, then they can prevent you from traveling. They can prevent you from going any place, buying food. So we're going to deal with this. None of this is conspiracy theory. It is all fact. But we always start with something upbeat and positive that can impact all of us. In developed nations and Eastern countries, Western medicine is almost always used. Okay, I guess that's a good thing, unless it's 88% of what we use, which fails miserably. How do we know? Well, we did the article, and I suggest you read it, Death by Medicine. And now there's a new publication out, and it's the World Death Clock. It shows you how many people die around the world each year from which conditions. And we're right at the top in the United States of killing more people using medications or improper medical diagnosis or procedures than anywhere else in the world. It can go anywhere from 500,000-600,000 up to a million. And we have proof of that. So if we're saying that everybody should be covered by insurance, I agree, but they should be able to get therapies that don't kill them. And that means using alternative and complementary medicine that has been proven by at least 10 qualified studies in the peer-reviewed literature on PubMed, the Library of Medicine, the government's official place, then nobody can say, well, this is just kind of alternative or quackery, you know, mimicking the words of the people on Wikipedia, the skeptics. No, we have to pay attention to Chinese medicine, that which is published in the peer-reviewed literature, because it has phenomenal results helping with chronic diseases, diabetes, cancer, heart disease, dementia, Alzheimer's, and gastrointestinal conditions. That's what this study said from two separate universities. So that's good. From Maharishi Kan University in Taiwan comes a study about the citrus peel, you know, orange peel, grapefruit peel, lemon and lime. Now, in some of the natural hygiene communities back in the 1950s and 60s and early 70s, because I went to one to see the head of it and ask him, what proof do you have that your natural hygiene approach works? His name was Dr. Herbert Sheldon. And he showed me, introduced me all these different patients he had there. There must have been 50 of them. And they were getting some good results, according to them. They looked extremely emaciated to me. And he had them on long fast. And ultimately, I considered his program dangerous. But part of it was not. It's how far you go with something. Going out for a 3-mile run and using interval training, meaning faster and slower, if you're wanting to keep in top shape, that is terrific. Going out for a 6-mile run is dangerous, unless you're racing. Unless you're racing for a period of time, then letting your body rest. But in America, we start something, we get into it, and we just keep going more and more and more until we burn our muscles out. Now we know you can prematurely age your muscles. Even though you may look great for your age, your muscles are not, because you prematurely overtrained, overraced. So as a whole nation, we're suffering from this. I counsel people all the time on this. So One of the things that I saw with the natural hygiene, and that I would later incorporate into the training schedule of all those athletes who were doing it right, because we would do the least amount of training of any of the clubs in New York. I'm guessing more or less at that time about 115 to 25 running and walking clubs. And we're one of the oldest, by the way, and still active. And we've had tens of thousands of athletes complete the New York City Marathon. We have some of the best athletes in the world. They were regular people when they started, now like Sam Skinner and Sid Howard and Thelma Wilson, all these people, they became world champions and sustained it. But I would have them drink a citrus drink each Monday after their long workout on Sunday. And in this citrus drink, they would have the whole lemon, the whole lime, the whole grapefruit, and the whole orange, skin and all. Because what was in the white pulp that no one ever eats is bioflavonoids, very high amount. But now we found out that there are ingredients in the skin that are very powerful. In fact, there is what is called nobilitin, N-O-B-I-L-E-T-I-N. And that, according to this university study, ameliorates or brings down the high fat-induced vascular and renal changes by decreasing inflammation. So it turns off inflammation in your lungs, turns off inflammation in your arteries, turns off inflammation in your kidneys. That's good news. All because of this nobilitin, N-O-B-I-L-E-T-I-N. It's a flavonoid. It's in the peel, not the flesh. And on vascular and renal alterations, and especially if you're like the average person on a high-fat diet. So one more reason, and they got that right, the natural hygienist, use the whole food. Okay? It makes a difference. And it can turn off inflammation. And your longest workout is always the one that gives you the most inflammatory cytokines. So you can feel great, and people do. You've got that runner's high. You've got endorphins, natural opiates you created from that long workout over an hour. And that can last most of the day. And so you feel good, you look in a mirror, you like what you see, you're ripped, you got a lot of good muscle definition, got your abs going on, tightness, not much fat. And but there's one thing, anytime a runner, any runner says, hey, you look good, you don't look good. You look like a skeleton. I can't tell you how many times, Gary, you look good. And then I'd see a picture of myself. The first time was when I was with Regis Philbin out in California. He used to fly out there and do his morning show. And I looked at myself and I said, oh, my God, I'm just too thin. And Regis and I had this conversation. I'd be on Regis' show almost his whole career. And I helped him. I put him on a health protocol. And he was a fun guy, very open, very vulnerable, you know, no defense mechanisms up. And he said, you know, Gary, I would put on a little weight if I were you. I said, why is that, Regis? He said, because you look gaunt. You know, you got those kind of sunken cheeks, high cheekbones, it accents it. And he was right. Back then, I don't know if they do it now, but every show had a photographer, and they would take pictures of the guests and give a copy of the photo to the guest with the host on set. And he was right. So I went up in weight 10 pounds. I didn't lose my speed. It's just that I filled my face out, because one of the first places you lose weight when you're on a diet is your neck and your face. So you can have that gaunt look. But if you do it right, you're not going to lose all that. You're going to lose weight proportional. So in any case, when you're working out, unless you're training for a specific race, in which case you give yourself as much time after the race as mileage in the race. So if you do a marathon, you don't do any kind of workout at all. Just go out and keep loose, stretch, walk for 26 miles. For 26 days. If you do a 10-mile race, then next 10 days, take it very easy. Let your body recover. It's just that when you're really in great shape, you think you're indomitable, in which case, and indestructible, you're not. Your cells are aging prematurely. That's why you always have to have a shake afterwards, giving your body back protein and anti-inflammatories, vitamin C, vitamin E. Really good. Vitamin E in particular with tocotrienols turns off inflammation. SAMe turns N-acetylcysteine, alpha-lipoic acid. These are terrific for turning off inflammatory cytokines. So you get the benefit of the workout, but you don't get the premature aging of the cells. Anyhow, loneliness and wisdom. What do I mean? Over the last few decades, there's been growing concern about loneliness across all ages, particularly in middle-aged and older adults. Loneliness is defined by feeling of isolated self or not having an adequate number of meaningful personal connections. And it's consistently associated with unhealthy aging and has been identified as a major risk factor for overall bad outcomes, including dying early. But in this recent cross-cultural study, researchers from San Diego School of Medicine, University of Rome, and other places looked at loneliness in other cultures, and wisdom had a strong negative correlation. The study was published in Aging and Mental Health, and it suggests wisdom can protect you against loneliness. That's right. An important finding of their study was a significant inverse correlation between loneliness and wisdom. People who were at higher scores of wisdom were less lonely and vice versa. So loneliness was consistently associated with poor general health, worse quality of sleep, less happiness, whereas when a person was wise. And what makes a person wise? Well, there's several things. It's not just one. The quality of their education. Were they in an environment at home that provided constant challenge? In having an animal sanctuary for almost my entire adult life, one of the most important things you have to do for those creatures you've rescued and now you want to get them a home for life, they almost always have been in abusive places, is you have to have them feel safe, loved, and then one day you start seeing they're playful. And like, I'll give you an example with a monkey, a shy monkey that's been abused probably in a breeding camp, which are terrible. So you put her in with one other monkey, a female, if it's a female, because they bond, and they'll hide in a corner. They'll stay inside of a little box. They won't come out because they're so afraid. But it's the other monkey that gets them to come out. And then they start, it might take them 6 months just to be able to touch your hand. But then once they see that you're there to share love, and then you start playing with them, they see you play because they see what you're doing with the other person, hugging, grooming, you know, playing. Then they want to be a part of it. But it's a slow process. And one day, they want to be, you know, they want you to take their tail and bring them around in circles, and much like you do a kid. Suddenly they come out of that, and then they want to see where's the food. So they'll start going through your pockets. Well, one of the things you do for what is called enriching an environment, you have to constantly realize that they're like kids. So you have to constantly be showing movies, animal movies, and not bad movies, you know, fun movies. And then you play music that they like, and that enriches their environment. And then you take food and you stick it, treats, and you stick it in different pockets, and you tie the whole thing up in knots, because they love just sitting there unraveling that and finding. When they finally open up the knot and they find the pocket and they unbuckle the pocket and they reach in there and they find themselves with a walnut, and they'll laugh. You know, that's fun to them. So anytime you grew up in an environment where it's an enriched environment, where you have a mother, father, others, aunts and uncles, grandparents, that provide a stimulus. And that's one of the wonderful qualities of all cultures around the world. The older men and women are always considered the wiser ones because they've had a life of experience. They've gone through all kinds of traumas and crisis and loss. So they can help you understand what you're facing, the transitions of life. But if you live in an isolated or protected or a bubble environment, as a whole generation, two generations have, and now a third generation, then you don't really have the experience of the world and how to cope with these things. So you just withdraw within yourself. So we want to help people by reading, by listening to classical music and writing and creating. Because one of the best ways in the world to up your wisdom skills is creating something from scratch that you're mastering. It takes discipline, it takes focus, it takes attention. Be active, not passive. It is in active participation in life that is challenging that you develop that innate wisdom. Just something to think about, because that's one way we can help people with loneliness. And finally, from St. Michael's Hospital in Toronto, published in the peer-reviewed journal Thorax, cannabinoids are associated with a negative respiratory health effects in older adults with COPD. This researcher's published the first data on the impact of cannabinoids on respiratory health of individuals with COPD. And by the way, for those of you who are not aware of it, and we have new listeners every day to this program, the cannabinoids, C-A-N-N-A-B-I-N-O-I-D-S, that's a class of prescription pills that contain synthetically made chemicals found in marijuana. They're associated with a 64% increase in death among older adults with chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, according to the first published study on the impact of cannabinoids on respiratory health in individuals with lung disease. So we have to look at everything before we start a protocol to see, is this right for me? And a lot of people have been told, well, smoke marijuana if you have these conditions because of lessened pain. Well, what if in the process of, yes, lessening pain, you also increase your prospect of death or lung cancer or a cancer elsewhere in the body? So always look for what you can do. Now, I've worked with a lot of people with COPD, helping two people in just the last year completely reverse it. And COPD is a progressive lung disease that causes difficulty breathing and chronic production of a non-productive cough. And it's generally associated with a wide variety of respiratory conditions like chronic muscle pain, insomnia. So what you want to do is you want to take into the diet everything that is in juice form, like your green juices, and in seeds, like sunflower, pumpkin, and sesame seeds, and in a plant-based diet, in clean water, that in allowing exercise that allows the inflammation to be turned off. Vitamin C turns off inflammation. That's your number one. Simple things can make a difference. Oh, and by the way, I mentioned this, I think, 3 weeks ago in a study. Now there's a new University of Otago study, which is in New Zealand, that says that exercise is a key to halting the progress from diabetes to heart disease. Because what happens is that that exercise triggers a release of small sequences of genetic code in the heart called microRNA, which increase protein production to improve heart structure and function. So every time you exercise, if you have diabetes, you're helping your heart and you're lessening the idea of a cardiac event. Okay, what we call diabetic heart. This was published in the peer-reviewed journal Circulation Research. We're almost 25 minutes into our program. I'm Gary Nall. We always want to empower people. And I want to leave you, before we take our break, with this. This is from Common Dreams. Just today it says, the rich are mostly fine, but the poorest completely crushed after COVID-19 triggered, quote, the most unequal recession in modern U.S. history. And so the rich are getting richer and the poor they're eliminating their low-wage jobs at 800% higher than high-wage jobs. In fact, the bad part is even people whose companies are going broke and closing are getting huge bonuses and the employees nothing. So that's something that has not been addressed by any administration. They're all pro-big business. They're all pro-Wall Street. So the whole idea that in this duopoly of Republican-Democrat, conservative and liberal, that you want your person because they're going to look after your interest, that's a complete delusional mindset. None of these politicians, not Obama, not Bush, not Reagan, not Ford, not Trump, none of these people are looking after you. They're only looking after themselves and the people that sponsor them. And that's big business. So what is your solution? What will remedy this? How will we help the tens of millions of people who are unemployed and not going to find employment, who are small business people whose businesses are out, not going to open again, who's lost their life savings? What is your suggestion for a remedy? I'd like to hear it. Please call in. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, I'm going to play you just a few minutes of Robert F. Kennedy, and you can watch it at prn.fm, or you can listen to it. But just understand, the media, all the media, got it wrong by a huge major. First, they politicized it and weaponized the dialogue. He's only talking to a small group of neo-Nazis and Trump supporters. Not true. A million people were there. 99% good people. Yes, there were some segments. In fact, I had to write a friend of mine a personal note last night, because this guy is, unfortunately, he's one of those people that no matter what the truth and facts are, if his ideology says that, well, I can't believe that, then no matter what proof you provide, he won't believe it. And that's unfortunate, because that's how fascism reigns. And right now we have fascism everywhere in the media. Back in a moment, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. in Berlin with a million people and positive messages, just so you can see it actually happen, and they were not to be believed.
The newspapers are saying that I came here today to speak to about 5,000 Nazis.
Zu Hause in den Vereinigten Staaten behaupten die Zeitungen, ich wäre hierher gekommen, um mit 5,000 Nazis zu reden.
And tomorrow they're going to report that, yes, I was here and that I spoke to maybe 3,000 to 5,000 Nazis.
Und morgen werden sie genau das berichten, dass ich zu etwa 83 bis 5,000 Nazis geredet haben werde.
And I look at this crowd and I see the opposite of Nazism.
Und wenn ich in die Menge schaue, sehe ich das Gegenteil von Nazis.
I see people who love democracy.
Ich sehe Menschen, die Demokratie lieben.
People who want open government.
Menschen, die eine offene Regierung wollen.
People who want leaders that are not going to lie to them.
Menschen, die für Anführer haben wollen, von denen sie nicht belogen werden.
People who are not leaders who will not make up arbitrary rules and regulations to orchestrate obedience of the population.
Wir wollen keine Anführer, die wahllos irgendwelche Regelungen erlassen, um unsere Demut, um unsere Unterwürfigkeit zu erwirken.
We want health officials who don't have financial entanglements with the pharmaceutical industry, who are working for us and not big pharma.
Wir wollen Anführer, die keine Verbindungen mit der Pharmaindustrie haben, die für uns arbeiten, nicht für die Pharma-Lobby.
We want officials who care about our children's health and not about pharmaceutical profits or government control.
Wir wollen Politiker, die sich um die Gesundheit unserer Kinder kümmern und nicht um den Profit der Pharma-Lobby und ihren eigenen Profit.
I look at this crowd. I see all the flags of Europe. I see people of every color. I see people from every nation, every religion, all caring about human dignity, about children's health, about political freedom. This is the opposite of Nazism.
Wenn ich in die Menge schaue, sehe ich Flaggen aus aller Herren Länder hier in Europa.
You wouldn't know any of that existed if you read or listened to any and all of the mainstream media. I'm going to go through several issues right now, probably 10 to 15, just to give you an idea of what we're faced with and what our solution should be. First, from Pam Long of Children's Health Defense. Microchips, nanotechnology, and implanted biosensors, the new normal. Quote, U.S. military personnel will be the first subjects in nanotechnology's trial in the pursuit of optimizing health and early detection of disease outbreaks. See how they put that? Oh, yeah. Yeah. Sign me up. I want to know if I've got an illness, and this is the ticket. Profusa has research contracts for bio-integrated sensors with U.S. Department of Defense and DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency, and I can assure you DARPA does not do anything to ensure your health. And now it's up for FDA approval. Profusa's promotional video shows how bio-integrated sensors enables a soldier to be tracked by remote computers using GPS. In addition to monitoring real-time biomarkers, they'll be able to know your oxygen levels, your heart rate, everything about your body. And while this biotechnology is portrayed as potentially life-saving to a soldier on a battlefield, the implications of GPS tracking your body as an individual is a terrifying step towards a surveillance state in the general population. Furthermore, tracking people in stages of sickness can only result in medical tyranny in the hands of any government. The Profusa influenza study requires patients to wear the wearable version of the reader 24 hours a day with continuous biomarker information collection into databases and aims to detect four stages of infection. And these unreliable detection stages could become the criteria for different levels of individual participation in society, because society could say, and this is my own thoughts on this, society could say, like China, you've been an activist. You've written some articles or spoken out. You attended some lectures or you demonstrated, and therefore that's not good. So without even you being aware of what's being monitored about you and how they're analyzing you, you're a threat. Now, they've already had the FBI. We know this for a fact because WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, released the confidential information about how the FBI had infiltrated every Occupy Wall Street group. And we also know, going clear back to the Black Panthers, they had infiltrated every anti-war group in the country or any civil group that is peaceful but wants to make change, even environmental groups. They've involved people in those and agent provocateurs. So imagine that you listen to this radio program. They already have that information. And now you have this. They can track you and they can do anything they want to you. Now add in that the whole new idea of reading your mind, reading your brain by attaching a chip into your right by your spinal column, you think that artificial intelligence and transhumanism couldn't possibly figure out what I'm thinking or what I've thought. Yes, they can, because everything you've ever thought, ever said, ever done in your life is in your neurons. It never leaves. As a result, these memory cells can be downloaded. Yeah, how would you like that? How would you like the government or private corporations to know everything you've ever thought, said, or done in your life? So this is here now. Nanotechnology has three components: an inserted sensor called hydrogel, that's a light-emitting fluorescent sensor reader on the surface of the skin, and the electronic software component that transmits it to an online database. And the SARS-2 vaccine, the one that you're all going to be getting — I'm not going to get it, but you're going to get it. If you don't mind, fine. That's your business. I mind. But that vaccine they're going to give you will incorporate this same identical technology. Yes, and there is no information on how the technology could be removed, if at all. Once in you, these tiny biosensors that become one with your body, you can't get rid of them. You can't turn them off, and you can't take them out. The nanotechnology research at DARPA is very controversial and aims to create super soldiers with artificial intelligence that gives enhanced capabilities to humans, like heightened senses and tenfold vision and extraordinary, you know, strength, just like you've seen some of those sci-fi films. Yeah, well, that's what they're doing. The Neuro and Engineering System Design, it's called. It aims to develop an implantable neural interface able to provide advanced signal resolution and data transfer bandwidth. That means they can control every thought They can program you to do what they want to do, and you will not have the ability to resist it. So now, the vaccines can be the Trojan horse for worldwide adoption of nanotechnology. The Institute of Soldiers Nanotechnologies at MIT and the U.S. Army Medical Research Institute of Infectious Disease are researching the use of nanotechnology-based adjuvants in new vaccines for the military against malaria, tuberculosis, HIV, and Ebola. But it's going to be involved in our getting a standard vaccine. Just want to let you know what's coming at you. Also, if any of you have ever wondered, and I'm sure many of you have, why is it that some of these looters and some of the people engaged, not in peaceful demonstrations, but rather in the violence, it seems to be orchestrated. There's just too many coincidences where they all show up at once. Well, according to the following from Farrah Stockman, she is a member of the New York Times editorial staff, quote, "On the last Sunday in May, Jeremy Quinn, a furloughed photographer in Santa Monica, California, was snapping photos of suburban homams kneeling at a Black Lives Matter protest when a friend alerted him to a more dramatic subject, looting at a shoe store about a mile away. He arrived to find young people pouring out of the store, shoeboxes under their arms, but there was something odd about the scene. A group of men dressed entirely in black milled around nearby, like supervisors. One wore a creepy rubber Halloween mask. The next day, Mr. Quinn took pictures of another store being looted. Again, he noticed something strange." And again, it was the men dressed in black. "And he had a crowbar, and he walked up and broke a window, but he didn't take anything. Mr. Quinn began studying footage of looting from around the country and saw the same black outfits and, in some cases, the same masks. He decided to go to a protest dressed like that himself to figure out what was really going on. He expected to find white supremacists who wanted to help re-elect President Trump by stoking fear of black people. What he discovered instead was true believers in insurrectionary anarchism. To better understand them, Mr. Quinn, a 40-something theater student who worked at Univision until the pandemic, has spent the past 4 months marching with Black Bloc, BLOC, anarchists in half a dozen cities across the country, chronicling the experience on his website, a public report. He says he respects the idealistic goal of a hierarchical free society that anarchists embrace, but grew increasingly uncomfortable with the tactics used by some anarchists, which he feared would set off a backlash that would help get President Trump reelected. And then he goes on to talk about how these people are true anarchists. I told you this some time ago, that once you make the mistake of conflating peaceful demonstrations, which I fully support, have engaged in myself and led hundreds of demonstrations, that thousands upon tens of thousands of you have participated in. Remember the 8,000 people in this audience who marched to Washington, D.C. over 10 days, peacefully, well-organized, and we made our message, and that became the message that was spread clear across to the United States about the dangers of GMOs. That's where it originated. All the articles and the documentary that came from that, that helped people make up their mind about how good organic and locally grown was and how dangerous GMOs were. History has shown and science has shown we were right. Just look at the lawsuits lost by Monsanto and now Bayer because it caused cancer, their glyphosate. Now there are 80,000 lawsuits against Bayer. We were talking about that then, but the media wouldn't touch it. The New York Times, nobody would touch how bad Monsanto was. We were right. They were wrong. But we only knew we were right after documents came out in trial. So what I'm saying now is this. There's a small but growing movement, professionally orchestrated, to bring down all institutions in America. Now, this guy says that he's happy about bringing down these, you know, but he just doesn't like the way it's being done. So what happens when the public sees a protest and then sees the violence, they assume that the people in the protest are also engaged in the violence. That's not true. Most people in protests are peacefully protesting. They'd be loud, and they can, you know, they can be strident, and that's fine. That's their right. But that doesn't mean that they're an anarchist and they're going to go and loot and steal from someone. That doesn't mean they're going to go into a minority neighborhood and burn down all the small businesses they did in Ferguson. But they're a group of people who are. And yet Jerry Adler would have us believe in others didn't exist. Well, it does exist. But just keep in mind, once you allow that to happen and you didn't take steps to stop the anarchists from this destruction, then there's a point to where you can't stop them. So just keep in mind, they're out there, they're well organized, and finally the New York Times drops a story. Not because it did anything to uncover it, which it could have. Someone had to give them the story. Well, what great journalism. We'll give you a story and maybe you'll do something with it. So that's the truth about a lot of that anarchism. And by the way, if you want to see anarchism at its fullest, go back and look at the history, read about the history from, let's say, 1790 to 1793 in France, where in order to challenge the inequality, they destroyed the society. Nothing better came from it, if you know your history. Also from other words by Philip Bennis, quote, the Pentagon took money for pandemic and bought weapons. That's right, they were supposed to use it properly, and the Pentagon used it on weapons. Will anybody be held accountable for the $1 billion they took from the stimulus that then went, instead of buying masks and other protective equipment for the pandemic, it went for weapons manufacturers? No, nothing will happen. Not in an unaccountable society. And that's unfortunate. I mentioned that Anthony Fauci's been called a fraud. Well, I found the individual statements, and there's a lot of them. And I want to read you a couple of the statements because I was there, I was writing about it, I was doing 5 award-winning documentaries, I did over 100 broadcasts, I did press conferences, and of course, most importantly, I was treating for free 1,200 people with full-blown AIDS and reversing all AIDS, including HIV status, in 15 of them, all documented. That's why I ask you to watch the documentary. It's free. It's up on PRN.fm. AIDS is not a death sentence. In any case, here are some people at the time who were yelling back at Fauci. And this just happens to be a Nobel Prize winner, Dr. Kary Mullis, who discovered the PCR. That's his invention. He won the Nobel Prize in 1993 in chemistry for that. And he said that much of what Fauci and others were doing was not real science. It was political science, economic science. And then I'll give you one of his statements here. He says, if you think a virus is the cause of AIDS, do a control with it. To do a control is the first thing you teach undergraduates. But it hasn't been done. The epidemiology of AIDS is a pile of anecdotal stories selected to the virus AIDS hypothesis. People don't bother to check the details of popular dogma or consensus views. By the way, he has a lot of good statements. And he's simply asking for a more detailed proof because the antibody test, which Robert Gallo patented, makes hundreds, I'm guessing hundreds of millions of dollars in profits from, it's nonspecific. Meaning, if you have leprosy, tuberculosis, malaria, if you're pregnant, if you've had a flu shot, if you've had the flu, if you have herpes, you could test positive for having HIV, even though you don't have HIV. And a lot of people tested positive and then were put on antiretroviral drugs like AZT at 1,600 milligrams a day, and they died from the AZT. So it's very dangerous when you're not doing good science. But this is another person. This is a PhD biochemist, protease inhibitor developer, University of California professor. He says, people can have a high viral load and be healthy and have a low viral load and be sick and everything in between. These guys will admit this between themselves. They just don't admit it publicly. So he's saying that what they were measuring when they were measuring people with AIDS was inaccurate. He was correct. There's one more person, Dr. Charles Thomas. He is a former professor of biochemistry at Harvard, former professor of biochemistry at Johns Hopkins University, former chair of the cell biology department at Scripps Research Institute. He is a heavyweight. And he said this, I often wonder what would happen if all federal money for AIDS, education, research, treatment, and so forth was suddenly dropped to zero. It is my belief that AIDS would go away. In other words, the AIDS diseases that we see today would be reassigned to their former categories, pneumocystis greening pneumonia, Kaposi's sarcoma, and the other 25 or so different diseases now including cervical dysplasia and so forth. AIDS has been a disease of definition. If we said that it didn't exist and didn't pay for it with taxpayer money, it would disappear into the backdrop of normal death. So what he was saying was, he did not deny HIV as a virus. What he said was that if you make everything about AIDS and you control what AIDS is, then what would happen if you looked at normal death, normal disease by the conditions that they called AIDS? And he challenged them on that. Anyhow, there's 3,000 quotes that I have. No, excuse me. I've got about 8,000 quotes from 3,000 different scientists and physicians who challenged Anthony Fauci. Have you heard of any of them? Read any of it? No, and you won't. Now we're going to close out our program today with, by the way, we have one person just called in. Before we close out with Jonathan Haidt, let's say hello to Frank from Manhattan. Hi, Frank, your turn.
Hi, Gary. Gary, those anarchists that you hear about, most of those people work for the states. They're there to disrupt, and they're there to destroy. They did it in the 70s, COINTEL, and they're doing it now.
I don't doubt that. As I said, remember, historically, the FBI and other governmental agencies have infiltrated groups and were agent provocateurs. I believe the Pacifica was in part destroyed, and it has been, because of agent provocateurs, and you will never hear anyone discuss that. Agent provocateurs can act like your best friend, and their whole intent is to bring down your cause. So I absolutely believe that there's a lot of agent provocateurs who are out there engaged in anarchistic activity, hoping that peaceful demonstrators will be blamed for it. Thank you, Frank. I appreciate your call. And now, going back to the larger issues of society that I'm going to hold off till Monday to talk about debt, I want you to hear from a person that I have a lot of respect for. He's one of those professors at Seoul. The removal of reason, critical thinking, freedom of speech at universities and replaced by this coddled, entitled, spoiled, petulant group of people, not representing the majority of students, but a powerful minority. And so Jonathan Haidt, a professor at NYU, he began to talk out about it. Now, he's been attacked for it. But listen to what he has to say about safe spaces and stifling vigorous intellectual debate.
Welcome to Australia. What did you see on university campuses in the last 5 years that led you to co-author The Coddling of the American Mind?
So I'm a professor at New York University. I've been a professor since 1995. I love being a professor. I love teaching. We get to be provocative. We get to explore ideas with our students. And then suddenly, from out of nowhere, around 2014, strange stuff started happening. Some students were bringing in an approach to intellectual life that was fearful, that acted as though ideas or speakers or books were dangerous. And my friend Greg Lukianoff first noticed this and came to talk to me about how students were engaging in a kind of thinking which was exactly the cognitive distortions that he had learned to stop doing when he was treated for depression with cognitive behavioral therapy. So we wrote up an article on this, on how all these new practices on campus, requests for trigger warnings, safe spaces, microaggression training, were likely to make students depressed and anxious. And then soon after our article came out, there was a wave of shout-downs and protests and no platforming. So academic life changed pretty quickly in the United States between 2014 and 2017.
And so why are those phrases, the ones that you mentioned, trigger warning, safe spaces, deep platforming, why are they damaging in a university environment?
Because a university is a special place. A university is not like the public square. It's not like your home. A university is a place that is created so that people will explore ideas. And the magic of it is that since we all suffer from confirmation bias, we all seek out evidence to confirm our pre-existing beliefs, a university is one of the few places where you can count on other people challenging you, looking for the evidence you can't find. So we can't work without dissent. We can't work unless we know that if we say something, people will challenge us. And as soon as a kind of an orthodoxy comes in, where certain things are the law and you can't challenge them, you can't question them, we can't do our job anymore.
You told the Australian newspaper, I think, there's a very good chance that American democracy will fail, that in the next 30 years we will have a catastrophic failure of our democracy. Why are you so pessimistic?
I've been studying political polarization since 2007. I've been very concerned about it. We have rising cross-partisan hatred. We have rising dysfunction in our political institutions. So I was concerned about that before the last few years. And what I've learned in writing The Coddling of the American Mind is that we have two mega trends coming that are going to make things so much worse than they've been. And so one is social media, which is already here. Social media shreds any sense that we live in a shared world. It's very difficult to agree on facts, and that's likely to get worse and worse. The other megatrend is the arrival of Gen Z or Gen Z. So Greg Lukianoff and I were studying how Gen Z has transformed college campuses. But as this new generation, these are kids born in 1996 and after, we overprotected them, we gave them social media too early, we raised them in ways that encouraged fragility. It's very hard for them to compromise. It's very hard for them to work with someone whose values they reject. They want to be protected from that. Well, that's bad enough in college. It makes it very hard to have good conversations and discussions in college. But now take that out into the public square. Take that out into companies. It's going to be very hard, I think, for Gen Z to work in a diverse democracy. So this is why I'm particularly alarmed. I think that however hard our challenge is now in the United States, it's going to be much harder in the coming decades.
So you're now in Australia to see how the Australian system compares to the United States. What have you found?
If you look at all the different threads, all the things that came together to cause the explosion in the United States around 2015, you have a few of them, but not all of them. So one of the biggest ones is the huge wave of anxiety and depression that hits Gen Z. So you have that. I spoke at the University of Melbourne. I've spoken with a few dozen Australian professors. And it's very clear that your teenagers, your kids born after 1996, are much more depressed, anxious, and fragile than they used to be. So you have that. But your universities are not residential the way ours are. That is, in an American university, you've got 18-year-olds who've never been away from home before, coming, living on campus in a tight community, and if certain ideas, if certain woke ideas become dominant, well, then they spread through everyone, and all kinds of more and more extreme ideas. So the idea that speech is violence, everything is violence, it's a way of speaking that becomes very common in certain academic subcultures in America. But if you're a student in Australia and you come to campus and someone says that and it doesn't make much sense, and then you go home at night to your parents, who are going to say, what? What do you mean speech is violence? So I'm not seeing the extreme politicization, the aggressive wokeness that we have on American.
We have to say goodbye to WBAI because we have to give them 5 minutes at the end of the program. So we thank you at WBAI for listening. But this is an important discussion, so we're going to continue on PRN.FM. So you want to hear the rest of it, just go to PRN.FM. For BAI, we'll see you on Monday.
That are putting everyone on notice, and so we'll see whether Australia tips over the way America has.
So the federal government ordered a review of free speech on university campuses in Australia last year, and it found there was no crisis. So does that mean there's no problem?
To say there's no crisis just means that we're not in a state of red alert, we're not in a state where emergency measures are required. And so if that's what that statement meant, then it seems to me that that's true. It's not a crisis. But it's pretty clear that whatever metaphor you want, the raindrops are beginning to fall, so the storm is on the way, perhaps. I think that might be a good way to put it. I've heard enough stories from Australian professors that I would say this. If you do nothing, if your university establishment says, oh, there's no crisis, back to business as usual. In a few years, I think you will find yourselves in a university setting in which people are much more afraid to speak honestly. I think the trends are coming here.
I want to talk about modern parenting methods because
it's my favorite topic.
Yeah, in particular, the overprotection of children. If parents are working harder and longer than ever, how are they also spending more time with their children?
It appears now that we're all putting in too much time. I don't mean to say that quality is not important, but in America, we have what you might call an epidemic of overparenting. So kids need a secure base. Attachment theory and psychology tells us kids need a base that they can trust, they know that someone loves them. But the whole point of having that secure base is so that they can then go off and explore. They have to encounter things on their own, they have to take risks, and when things go badly, they can come back to the home base. But what if we never let them off the home base? Then they don't develop. And that, I believe, is what we've done to our kids in the United States.
But if safetyism means that there are fewer teen pregnancies and less young people drinking, isn't that a good thing?
If all else was equal, yes. Of course, a decline in teen pregnancy is a good thing. But it appears that that's not that our kids are normal, they're just being more responsible about sex. It's that our kids are not normal, they're not going out with each other, they're not dating, even in their 20s, they're not falling in love, they're not forming marriages. So yeah, there's a decline in pregnancy, and that's a good thing, but there's a decline in many forms of sociality, including many that are necessary for happiness. So the millennial generation is having a bit of this problem. They're having difficulty finding love, and they're having a lot less sex than previous generations. But Gen Z, it looks like, is going to be much more extreme, much less love, much less sex, much more depression, anxiety, and loneliness.
Yeah, your research has determined that that combination of overprotection from parents as well as social media has led to skyrocketing in suicide rates and depression and anxiety, particularly amongst young girls. How are the two connected?
The rise in depression and anxiety is massive. It starts around 2013 in the United States. And it hits girls mostly. All of this points to social media as one major cause. We think, Greg Lukianoff and I think, that the overprotection that hit the same generation in the 1990s when they were younger is also a contributor. We don't know which is stronger. Because of the sex difference, we're confident that social media is a major cause because girls use social media much more than boys. Secondly, girls are much more sensitive to the constant social comparison that social media fosters, much more sensitive to constant comparisons of whose life is perfect, who looks more beautiful. And with social media and all the filters on Snapchat and Instagram that can make you more beautiful, that's much harder on the girls. Also, boys' aggression is physical, and so when they go on social media, they can't be aggressive in that way. But girls' aggression is more about relationships. Girls are more skilled at, more thoughtful about who's related to who, and social media allows them to engage in that much more intensely. So we don't know the ratio, whether it's overprotection or social media. They both hit the same generation, Gen Z, at the same time. But given that this is happening in America, Britain, Canada, and Australia, it's not some local condition. The only real candidate is social media.
Okay. That's Professor Jonathan Haidt, and he's made some very important points we should consider. I want to thank you all for listening, and over the weekend, take some time and watch. Go up and look at all the video bios. There are 21 of them. That'll give you an idea of what I've been able to do, and we're challenging Wikipedia for not including any of this information and providing false information. Lawsuits are about to come. We've had 74 articles we've written, 11 lawyer letters, and now we're going through a defunding them. We're getting people all over the world, all over, Nobel Prize winners, top doctors, who have joined our petition because they also see the danger of Wikipedia and its biases. So more to come. Have a nice weekend, everyone.